Chapter 7 Paradise. Captain Nivelle accepted the Burgermeister's offer of hot water to make tea, and scattered some precious tea leaves into his cup. The tea would have hardly any taste, and that didn't matter. To the Ruhar, it was the ritual of drinking tea that was important.
Thank you, Madame Logelia. I have been considering something you said during our last conversation. What would be involved if our force declared loyalty to the Ruhar? And what would be the implications to our people here and on Earth? I assume the Kristang would learn of our switching sides.
She looked out the window.
It is a fine day. We should go for a walk.
It was not a particularly fine day, being overcast with the skies threatening rain and a chill in the morning air. They walked out of the building, down a road, then turned to walk along a dirt lane separating two fields. One of the fields was ready for harvest. It contained some kind of grain, like wheat or oats. The other field was in the process of being planted. A large machine was rolling along the rows at the far end of the field. From the field, Nivelle caught a whiff of whatever fertilizer the Ruhar used. It smelled vaguely like Parmesan cheese, and to Nivelle's nose, unpleasant. He ignored it. Reports had come into UNFHQ that some Ruhar who had contact with human soldiers mentioned the scarcity of fertilizer on Paradise. A Kristang raiding ship had hit a fertilizer factory 6 months ago, and the local Ruhar were complaining that their government was very slow to rebuild it. The local Ruhar were unhappy about many things, according to rumors that Nivelle gave credence to. The government was not making enough of an effort to rebuild and enhance infrastructure. The schedule for bringing back native Ruhar who had been evacuated was far too slow, and the schedule kept slipping. And most importantly, the local Ruhar complained that their fleet, which had recently won crushing victories, did not seem able or willing to protect them from what surely must be a small group of Kristang starships. When they had walked half a kilometer down the lane, talking about nothing but the weather, Logelia decided it was time to discuss the important subject.
General, it is unfortunate that I ever mentioned to you the possibility of your force switching allegiances in this war. I mentioned our conversation to my superiors, and they were dismayed the subject had been discussed at all. If you were to formally offer to change sides, I am afraid to tell you that the Ruhar government would not welcome it. My government would not accept the humans on Gitanu as clients at the present time. If the offer had been extended earlier, such as soon after our fleet regained control of Gitanu, the answer might have been different. Under the current circumstances, it is not possible.
Why? Has something changed in the strategic situation in this sector?
I should not be telling you this officially, and you must promise me that you will keep this a very closely held secret, General.
You have my word as a French soldier, General Nivelle said, mildly offended.
First, I must tell you that your communications are thoroughly compromised by my people. There are even nanoscale recording devices in some of your clothing. The devices embedded in the collar of your uniform have been disabled temporarily. She pointed to her own Z-phone. Any repetition of this conversation must be conducted with extreme caution.
Understood, Nivelle agreed, suddenly feeling his collar itching his neck. And agreed.
Cool, as your people say. General, my government, I refer to the federal government, not the planetary administration. The Ruhar federal government has been engaged in negotiations to give Gitanu, this planet, back to the Kristang.
Nivelle almost choked on his complete shock.
Sacre bleu. Why?
Logelia explained the strategic situation.
You must understand that my government never intended to recapture Gitanu in the last campaign. In short, General, this planet is not worth the military effort that would be required to keep it.
Nivelle was stunned. The entire Ruhar campaign to retake Paradise had been a ruse to draw in the Theranin and Kristang, and now the Ruhar wished to give the planet away?
Personally, she continued, I am opposed to any notion of surrendering my home planet. I was born here, and my mother was born here. Mine is only one voice. I am not even allowed to tell the local population about the negotiations. These raids by the Kristang,
she looked at the clouds,
only serve to reinforce my government's decision to trade away this planet.
Neville was greatly disturbed and chose his words carefully.
Your government would not welcome and would not accept our pledge of loyalty, because that would make them responsible for the humans here?
It would make us responsible, yes. All Ruhar. On this world, the issue of humans is important. Away from this star system, most of my people have never heard of humans. Or if they have, all they know is that humans serve our enemy. To accept your allegiance would mean my government accepts the tremendous expense of evacuating humans from this planet, and they would have to be resettled on a Ruhar world, where the local population would probably not be pleased to find an enemy in their midst. For my government, there is, as I believe your people say, no upside for this. We gain nothing by accepting your force as clients.
General Neville could not argue with her hard, cold logic. It made sense. It also meant disaster for his force.
Then it is good that I did not discuss the possibility of switching sides with anyone, not even my personal staff. I wanted to learn the implications from you first.
I do not know what impact there would be to Earth if you changed allegiances, because we do not know the situation on Earth. The Kristang there are cut off from the rest of their species after the wormhole shut down.
That is confirmed? It is not disinformation by the Kristang?
Neville asked anxiously. UNFHQ had heard rumors that the Kristang no longer had access to Earth. If it was true, then he needed to officially inform his troops before rumors got out of hand. Bad news, as the old saying went, did not improve with age.
The wormhole is in Kristang territory, she said, so we cannot verify it has truly gone dormant. However, I am told that we have very solid intelligence that the Kristang and Theranin have lost contact with your home planet.
Is that unusual for a wormhole to shut down like that?
It is very unusual. As we do not know how wormholes work, or why they have sudden shifts, we can't make any useful speculation about why that wormhole has ceased functioning. It may reactivate tomorrow, or it could signal another impending shift across the entire sector. We simply do not know.
General? She turned so they could walk back to her office. The sky was beginning to drizzle.
I am sorry about the situation you find yourself in. Your species did not ask to become part of this war. I do not have any advice for you. Having on my world a client species of our enemy is new to me. Again, I am sorry that you were drawn into this war.
Neville did not want to discuss regrets. He wanted to discuss action.
Do you know the status of the negotiations, the timeline for handing control of this planet to the Kristang?
My government has not consulted me, she said with a wry smile. So what I can tell you is from what I have heard from sources who are usually reliable. So far, the territory that the Kristang are offering in exchange for Gitanu is not sufficient, and the negotiations have been going back and forth. There are complicating factors. Although there is currently a limited ceasefire between the Jarraptha and the Theranin in this sector, it has not yet been agreed which territories the Jarraptha have captured. Some star systems the Jarraptha took control of during the conflict they may wish to give back to the Theranin in exchange for other more valuable territory. The Jarraptha wish to consolidate their gains and draw a new, more defensible border. That new border may affect what territory the Kristang are able to offer us, or may affect the value of that territory. Because the Jarraptha captured a wormhole cluster from the Theranin, the Jarraptha now control access to territory that is not inside their borders. She shook her head. As I said, the situation is very complicated. The Commodore of our defense fleet, she pointed to the sky, has told me that he thinks the ongoing Kristang raids are not aimed at retaking the planet. The Kristang force here is not strong enough to do that. The raids are aimed at making my government more willing to accept a lesser bargain in exchange for this planet. General, the true problem we face, you humans and we native Ruhar, is that my government very much wants to trade away Gitanu. Therefore, eventually they will reach a deal with the Kristang, and my people will leave this world. As to your people, I do not know what will happen.
Flying Dutchman. While we still hadn't selected one particular relay station to hit, Major Smythe began planning the assault. Smythe was glum about our chances.
"We can do it, sir," he told me without confidence. "We can take the station. I expect casualties to be heavy. Once we get inside, it will be a short and bloody battle. We will have the advantage of initial surprise and numbers. Between our troops and armor suits and combats, we outnumber them 3-1. The Theranin have the advantages of being genetically engineered cyborgs and being on the defensive. They know the terrain better than we do." "I wish," he said while looking around the empty cargo bay we used for training, "that we could build a replica of that relay station. It would be bloody helpful to train on the same ground where we'll be fighting."
"Huh?" He had given me a thought.
"Hey, Skippy, this type of relay station we will be assaulting, they build a lot of them?"
"Yes, they are now the most numerous type of relay station, Joe," he confirmed. "An entire class of cruisers became obsolete, and the Theranin used their obsolescence as an opportunity to create new relay stations. Why, are you not happy with our choice of target?"
"Unless our target was seizing control of a basket of kittens, I wouldn't be happy about it. No, it's not this particular station that bothers me. It's the high level of risk in the whole concept. My question is whether there are any of this type of station that have been abandoned because of battle damage or another reason."
"Sure there are, Joe. Only one has sustained sufficient battle damage to warrant it being abandoned. It was self-destructed to prevent it from falling into enemy hands."
"Ah, crap. I was hoping," he interrupted me again.
"But there are 7 others which have been abandoned after the recent wormhole shift because their location was deemed no longer useful."
"Were those 7 others also destroyed?"
"Not all of them. 2 were blown up because they are now in Jarraptha territory. The other 5 were mothballed, in case another wormhole shift makes them useful again. Their reactors were shut down, and all computer communication and data storage capability was removed, but they are still there, drifting along in cold storage."
"Great," I exulted. "Major Smythe, instead of us building a replica, how would you like your team to practice the assault on an actual data relay station?"
"Whoa!" Skippy shouted with a derisive laugh. "Wait just a minute there, Joe. You can't just..."
"Maybe you can just do that."
"Ah, damn it! The monkey says, duh, how about we do this, and he comes up with a good idea. Now why didn't I think of that? Stupid, stupid brain. Oh, I hate my life sometimes," he said with a sob.
"Huh. Now I see why I didn't think of that. I knew about these abandoned stations, but removed them from my list because they are inactive."
"That is interesting, Joe."
"I'm sure it is, Skippy. That wormhole shift won't stop us from accessing one of those stations, will it?"
"Quite the contrary, Joe. There is one particular derelict station that was left totally isolated from both Theranin and Jarraptha territory by the wormhole shift. It took a Theranin ship almost 18 months to retrieve the station crew after they were cut off. That station would be perfect for Major Smythe's team to practice. We would be assured of not having any visitors. I can use our Elder Wormhole controller module to temporarily connect to that dormant wormhole so we can go through and on our way back."
Joe, he lamented. "Do you do this sort of thing just to humiliate me?"
"No, Skippy," I assured him. "Of course not. Humiliating you is a bonus. Major Smythe, you can work with this?"
"Brilliantly, sir. We still have the hard part to do," I cautioned.
"Yes, sir," Smythe nodded. "But perhaps now it won't be quite so bloody hard." I contacted the bridge and we changed course toward the derelict relay station. Of course, I caught hell from Chotek for not informing him about the change of plans before I ordered the course change. That pissed me off. I was on my way to his office to tell him personally, but that wasn't good enough. We had a discussion that ended with me deciding that in the future I would take the 30 seconds to contact him before I ordered a major course change. 30 seconds is all it would take for me to swallow my pride and avoid an argument. The whole situation still pissed me off. Paradise.
"Can y'all believe this shit?"
Jesse asked while staring at his Z-phone in the hope that what he'd just read would change.
"It's crazy, man," Dave replied, shaking his head.
"No," Jesse looked up in frustration. "I mean, do you believe it?" Dave scrolled the screen to the top and pointed to the logo at the beginning of the message.
"UNFHQ believes it. This is official."
"That can't happen, can it?"
Jesse appealed for assurance. The message from UNFHQ stated that the wormhole that led back to Earth had closed, and the Kristang weren't able to reopen it. The expeditionary force on Paradise now had zero hope of ever getting home. Even if their former Kristang allies took Paradise back from the Ruhar, they could not bring humans back to Earth because the Kristang lacked the technology to make that long journey. Even for the advanced Theranin, such a voyage was wildly impractical.
"Wormholes don't just shut down for no reason," Jess protested.
"The one near Earth opened for no reason, Cornpone," Skee said gently. "That's what landed us in this mess in the first place."
"That's bullshit," Eric Koblenz said, spitting on the ground for emphasis.
Eric was part of another three-man ag team, a team that Jesse and Dave had partnered with to combine and expand their private plots of land into a significant field of wheat. The other two partners were good guys, but Eric had been a problem from the start. He did his share of the work. That wasn't the issue. The problem was that Eric was a keeper. Soon after the Ruhar took the planet back and UNFHQ ordered all humans to surrender, a movement called Keepers of the Faith had sprung up on the Z-Phone network. Keepers held that UNF should not have surrendered, that the Kristang were true allies, that the fortune cookie messages from Earth about the Kristang abusing humanity's home planet and enslaving the population were somehow all Ruhar lies, that UNF had come out to the stars to fight alongside the Kristang against the species that had attacked Earth, so UNF should keep doing that. Fight the Ruhar. Even if the expeditionary force on Paradise was wiped out to the last human, UNF would demonstrate to our Kristang allies that humans kept their word, and such a demonstration of steadfastness and resolve would benefit humans back on Earth. To Keepers, everyone else were traitors.
"That's all a lie by the hamsters," Eric spat again. "And the UNF HQ lackeys are just selling out again as usual. The wormhole near Earth didn't just open up recently. That's a lie the hamsters told us to explain why the Kristang had not been to Earth before they did. And that wormhole is not shut down now. The hamsters want us to give up hope so we'll be easy to control, and you traitors are stupid enough to listen to these lies."
"Oh," Dave sighed. "Not this BS again. Look, man, if you want to talk about your wacko conspiracy theories," he pointed to the jungle, "go put on your tinfoil hat and tell it to the trees, because I'm not wasting my time listening."
"Traitor?" Jesse asked angrily.
"You best be careful throwing around words like that, asshole. How exactly are we giving aid and comfort to the enemy?"
"Damn, Jesse, don't take the bait," Dave warned. But it was too late.
Eric put his arms across his chest.
"You give aid and comfort every day by not resisting them. The Ruhar know that sheep like you will never fight them, so they don't have to garrison many troops here. You're growing your own food, so the Ruhar don't have to manufacture human food and ship it in."
"Yeah, like you're not helping to grow food," Dave said sarcastically while pointing to Eric's hands, dirty from harvesting tomatoes and peppers from the fields.
"And I've noticed you haven't refused to eat this food we grew with the hamster's help.
See, Jesse? That's how moronic the sleepers are."
Dave used the derisive nickname for the Kristang loyalists.
"When we eat food we grew here, we're traitors. But when they do the exact same thing, they're loyal."
"Talk all you want. The Ruhar are keeping troops here and ships in orbit because they know if they don't, we keepers will take the planet back. We are assisting the Kristang by making the Ruhar keep combat resources here."
"Well, of course you are," Jesse scoffed. "They're afraid of what? The hoe you use in the fields? No, it must be the shovel you were using this morning. Hey, genius, the Ruhar hold the high ground. They can sit in orbit and pound the crap out of us down here, and there ain't squat we can do about it unless you weave together corn stalks to make a railgun."
"Shut up," Eric growled.
He waved a finger at Dave and Jesse.
"Your time will come. You'll see. You traitors will be crying then."
Dave grabbed Jesse's shoulder and squeezed.
"Stay cool, Jesse. This piece of crap isn't worth it. Don't do it."
Alarmed about breakdowns in discipline now that soldiers saw themselves as nothing but farmers, UNF had cracked down on fighting. Anyone who got into a fight, regardless of who started it, spent time in a hard labor camp. The prospect of building roads in the steaming jungle of Lemuria was an effective deterrent to fighting. For now. Jesse relaxed slightly, still ready if Eric threw a punch.
"You're right, Ski. Thanks for reminding me."
To Eric, he said, If y'all want to fight the hamsters, you sleepers best get at it, then. Leave us out of it, Jesse smirked. We don't want to be within 10 kilometers when the Ruhar turn where you're standing into a smoking crater. We do want a good view, Ski added. Oh, yeah, man. I wouldn't miss that, Jesse said with a laugh. Eric flipped them off with both hands and stomped off without another word.
You think those sleeper idiots would have woke the hell up when the lizards burned out that big field last month? Jesse mused.
A Krestang destroyer had popped into orbit and used its masers on a broad sweep to burn out several fields that were growing human food on Lemuria. There were several villages on Lemuria now almost entirely populated by keepers. It wasn't an official designation, but most non-keepers had asked for transfer out. The biggest field that had been targeted was a keeper village. The masers had scorched an entire season of crops and killed 31 people. Keeping the faith hadn't spared the village from the Krestang's predations. That destroyer had not targeted any Ruhar areas before it jumped away. It had focused entirely on damaging the human food supply.
Jesse, save your breath. You can't reason with idiots like him. They'll tell you that keeper village got hit because the Krestang see all humans as traitors. Their answer is we all need to be keepers. Then the Krestang will come back like Santa Claus down the chimney to reward all the good little girls and boys, Dave said in disgust.
Yeah, Jesse nodded. Like the school board in my home county. The answer to every problem is always they need more money. Whatever they were trying would have worked, if only they had more money.
They never stop to think maybe it's what they're doing that's the problem.
Amen to that, brother.
Dave held out a fist and Jesse bumped it.
They're like my Aunt Claire, Dave went on. When something bad happens to someone else, she says God is punishing them. When something bad happens to her, God is testing her faith. It's the perfect system. No matter what happens, she's right and everyone else is wrong.
She must be a lot of fun at the Thanksgiving table, Jesse said.
Dave shook his head.
Aunt Claire doesn't get invited to Thanksgiving anymore. That's mostly because her new husband drinks too much and says stupid stuff. Last time they were there, he knocked the gravy boat onto the floor. The only one in the whole family who misses him is the dog.
Jesse laughed.
That must have been the best dog Thanksgiving ever.
Then he looked at the sky, and his good humor faded.
We're never going home, are we?
Never.
We can't. This just can't be real. Can it?
All I can say for sure is if we really have no hope of ever going home again.
Dave glanced around warily. Eric had walked out of earshot, but he was talking with another keeper and shooting hostile looks in Dave's direction.
Discipline will be going to hell in a hurry around here.
Flying Dutchman. We had found the derelict Thuranan relay station right where Skippy said it would be. Before boarding, we checked out the interior with combots in case the Thuranan had left any booby traps. The little green men had not bothered to booby trap the place. They had stripped it of anything useful before they left. That left a perfect training environment for us. Major Smythe wasted no time in putting his Spec Ops team through practice runs, and I joined them, not because I fantasized about being a badass Special Forces soldier. I was realistic about that. I joined the practice runs because I wanted to see firsthand what Smythe's team would be facing. After a walkthrough, we get into our two dropships to practice an assault for the first time. The dropship was crammed with people. We'd removed the seats to get in as many people as we could. The only thing holding us in place was webbing. That was also our only cushioning when the dropship was maneuvering. Strapped in, I was putting my helmet on and banged it into the helmet of the person next to me.
Sorry, I said.
No problem, sir, she replied.
Her name was Lauren Poole. She was one of the U.S. Army Rangers who was new to the merry band of pirates. I suspected that Smythe had assigned her to babysit me. She kept popping up next to me in training.
It doesn't bother you to be upside down like that? I asked.
In order to cram people in, some people were hanging upside down from the dropship ceiling. To get loose, we all had to cut the webbing, and I was concerned that would create snag hazards. That was one thing we would discover in practice.
No, she replied with a twinkle in her eyes. I started gymnastics when I was 8 years old. Sometimes it feels like I've spent half my life upside down, sir.
All right. I shook my head and pulled down the faceplate of my helmet. Let's do this.
This is still going to be bloody hard, Smythe said as he took off his helmet.
His short hair was plastered to his scalp by sweat. I nodded, trying to catch my breath. We had just finished the sixth practice assault, the sixth time we had run through the final plan. This was after we tested five other plans multiple times. After the fourth exhausting day, I had lost count of how many times we had practiced various plans. I was worn out, and I wouldn't even be participating in the actual assault, so my role in practice was as an observer. What I had observed was not encouraging. Skippy acted as the red team, our opponent, and he assured us that he was dumbing down his reactions to match the Theranan cyborgs assisted by their AI. The combots that Skippy controlled were still lightning fast and deadly accurate. We had to use surprise, sheer numbers, and maximum firepower to accomplish the objective. On the first practice run, we had failed. The last of our special forces died before getting into the core of the station from which Skippy could access and shut down the station's AI. The second practice run was worse. We failed to breach the docking bay on our first attempt, and everyone died before they could leave the dropships. Having only two dropships was a serious limitation. Both had to act as transports, each crammed tight with spec ops people and combots. The interiors of both dropships had been stripped. No chairs remained. People were held in place by webbing to be cut away when they wanted release. After our failure to breach the docking bay on the second attempt, we tried the Dutchman making a micro jump to position the ship in front of the docking bay so the ship could hammer the doors open with her powerful masers. That third practice attempt ended with what at first seemed like a victory. Three of our special forces survived to penetrate the station's core, and Skippy was able to shut down the Theranan AI. Unfortunately, the Dutchman got blown up in the practice run, so it was a failure. Skippy warned us that his calculations showed we would lose the ship 92% of the time. Our beat-up star carrier could not survive combat at close range. So we went back to the original plan. As soon as our stealth dropships opened fire on the docking bay doors, the Dutchman would jump away and await an all-clear signal. The fourth, fifth, and sixth practice assaults were successful in that at least one person survived to reach the station's core. The fifth assault had the best result, because in the end there were five special forces and three combots left combat effective. This wasn't working. It's too difficult, Major, I agreed with Smythe when we had finished stowing our gear back aboard the Dutchman. Any operation that incurs 90% casualties is unacceptable, even if the survival of humanity might be at stake. The problem is that we lose too many people and combots while breaching the docking bay, Smythe observed, and then getting from the docking bay into the station proper. After that, we don't have the massed firepower to overwhelm the enemy defenses. It becomes a short war of attrition. Do we lose people and combats faster than we can advance? I know. I did. I'd been there. I'd seen combots go offline and people's armored suits go stiff as Skippy declared them dead. Maybe there's another way to breach that docking bay. Fly troops in just with suits, ahead of the dropships, Smythe mused. You've done an extensive space dive, sir. Yes, and I wouldn't recommend it. Major, let's get some rest tonight and try it fresh again in the morning. I would rather have another go at it today, sir. Smythe's tone indicated that I wanted a break because I was not Special Forces. Yes, you do, because you Spec Ops types are always go, go, go. When we conduct the actual assault, we'll do it with freshly rested soldiers. We'll rest tonight, then add fresh troops to the simulation tomorrow. Smythe nodded curtly, unconvinced. I will get up early tomorrow, said Smythe, who got up early every morning. I want to get the equipment checked out early. That will save us time that we can use for practice. I'll join you, I responded. Joe gets going a lot quicker in the mornings, Skippy chimed in cheerily, since he stopped shaving down there. It saves a lot of time. Damn it, Skippy, I don't shave down there. That's what I just said, you dum-dum. Man, open your ears and listen once in a while, he grumbled. Anyway, aren't those hairs already curly? Do you really need a curling iron down there? What? I don't... It's not... I sputtered, while the team laughed uncontrollably. Fine, whatever. Don't complain to me the next time you burn your thighs with that iron. I protested, feeling my face growing red already. Most of the special forces with us were new to the merry band of pirates. They didn't know how Skippy loved to make jokes at my expense. Shaking my head and holding up my hands, I walked out with what little dignity I had left. I'll see you at 0500, Major Smythe. Paradise. As a special treat, the residents of Fort Rakovsky, population 19, learned there would be a U.S. Army general visiting them the next day. They learned this information not from UNIF HQ or the general staff, but from the grapevine of villages the general had already visited on the tour. Since the general was traveling by Humvee and there were few roads in the formerly impenetrable jungles of Lemuria, it was easy to predict where the general would be going next. While it would have been nice for the general staff to announce visits ahead of time, his staff expected the Z-Phone network to do the announcing for them. Any village that was caught off guard had to be either not paying attention or was very much disliked by their surrounding villagers. Either way, such an incident would tell the general and his staff that something was seriously amiss. So the residents of Fort Rakovsky had the joy of spending a day of their off-duty time straightening up the village. Uncompleted hooches were worked on through the night, and all the buildings were cleaned. The already minimal amount of trash was consolidated. Personal garden plots were weeded once again, and selected ripe fruits and vegetables were picked a day ahead of the normal schedule. Someone found paint and used the back of a crate to make Fort Rakovsky signs to point on the roads coming into the village from east and west.
"This is the best it's going to get," Dave Chaika said while looking around the village's only street with a frown. "It's good enough," Jesse Coulter assured his buddy. "Here they come."
Around a corner of the road came three Humvees and a large truck, with lead vehicle flying both the UNIF and American flag. National flags were not encouraged, but this was the American sector of Lemuria, and a U.S. flag flew from a pole in the center of Fort Rakovsky. To avoid excess wear and tear on the priceless and irreplaceable fabric, the flag was normally kept wrapped in plastic in a box and only taken out for special occasions, like the rare times when people from another village came to Fort Rakovsky to trade and there was a woman with them. In those cases, the village was scrubbed top to bottom with far more vigor than was given to any visiting general. The general made a cursory inspection of the village, then walked over to check the fields, his chief interest on the tour. Mostly he wanted to see what soldiers were growing on their personal plots of land. After an hour, he came to the extensive plot that Jesse and Dave shared with three other guys.
"Impressive," General Marcellus observed. "This land belongs to the five of you?"
"The five of us work this land, sir. We get more done when we work together. But the land belongs to six people," Dave said.
The keeper, who had been a problem, had arranged a transfer to another village, and his replacement got along well with everyone.
"Six?"
Marcellus looked at the five men who were proudly showing their healthy personal crops.
"The other guy doesn't work?"
"He doesn't work the land, sir," Jesse explained. "He's good at fixing things, so he lets us work his land in exchange for a cut of the crops. He repairs and maintains equipment for us and other villages around here, and they trade stuff in exchange for his labor. We get a cut of whatever he gets in trade."
"I see. Captain Rivera, a word, please."
Marcellus walked a short distance with his staffer and frowned.
"This is a problem. This mechanic is trading away land that UNIF provided to him instead of using it to increase the food supply. He is not performing his assigned tasks," General Marcellus declared.
"Excuse me, sir, but I believe he is performing his assigned tasks during his duty hours," Captain Rivera said. "His personal activities are performed during his off-duty time."
"We gave people personal plots of land so they could grow food, Captain, not to use it as an excuse to slack off. Remind me again why I have an economist on my staff, and why the Marines sent an officer to Harvard to study economics in the first place?"
"Because, sir, the United States Marine Corps is a forward-thinking organization, and they anticipated Earth would be invaded by aliens, leaving a major force trapped off-world to develop its own independent economy," Rivera said with a deadpan expression. "My master's degree is in management. Economics was my undergrad major."
"And you signed up for the Marine Corps?"
Marcellus shook his head in wonderment. Rivera grinned.
"It turns out there are not a lot of practical applications for a bachelor's degree in economics."
"Did you consider the Coast Guard?"
"I wanted to see the world, sir. Seeing other worlds is a bonus."
"Then use your Harvard training to explain to me why I shouldn't discipline a soldier for trading away land that was given to him for the purpose of growing food."
"Because, sir, he is making the best use of the resources available to him, including his skill set. He might be terrible at farming, but he is good at fixing and maintaining equipment. If he used his off-duty time to grow crops, we would only have one more unskilled farmer. With the arrangement he has devised, his plot of land is being put to its best use, and his skills are being used to make people who are farming more productive by providing them with reliable equipment. Specialization of labor is key to an efficient economy. Everyone does what they do best. Eventually, sir, we will need to establish a form of currency. This barter economy of people trading corn for tomatoes and so on is inherently inefficient. Marcellus looked at the sky and muttered to himself,
"Some days I wish I was still a private carrying a rifle. Life was so simple back then."
"Yes, sir," Rivera said simply, because there wasn't anything else to say.
"Back in the Hamvees, Captain," Marcellus said. "We have another four of these villages to visit today."
Touring villages might not benefit the residents in any way, but they were opening Marcellus's eyes. His intel report back to UNFHQ should open some eyes there. His greatest concern was that as soldiers became full-time farmers, people were going to increasingly question what authority UNF had over them. Eventually, the military command and control arrangement would give way to, he shuddered to think, democracy, elections, politics.
What, he asked himself, was this world coming to? This alien world.
Flying Dutchman. An idea hit me at 0337 that morning. This time I literally did dream something up.
Hey, Skippy.
What?
Is it important? I'm watching a late-night infomercial about how I can get stains out of fabrics. It's not helpful, but it sure is funny.
That's great, Skippy. I have a question for you. Can you fake a high-security message from Theranan Military Command?
Please, Joe. Easier than you can get a red wine stain out of a white carpet.
Now, why would anyone install a white carpet in their house? And if they had white carpet, why would they buy red wine? Unless they bought white carpet and red wine just for an infomercial. I smell a conspiracy here, Joe.
And that mystery has confounded mankind for centuries, Skippy, I agreed.
Could you convincingly fake a message that the Dutchman is on a secret mission for the Theranan High Command or whatever, so we can fly dropships right into that relay station's docking bay?
Silence.
Skippy.
Listen, I'm sure that you could rewind that infomercial if you really...
Holy shit. Holy shit. Why didn't I think of that? Damn it. Joe. Joe, I hate my life. Oh, this is so humiliating.
That is a great idea.
Skippy, I promise that I won't tell anyone it was my idea.
Why, thank you, Joe.
Until breakfast. Thus reminding me of why I rightfully so very much hate you, Joe.
I love you too, Skippy. Don't get too cocky, monkey.
Of course I can create a convincing message with the proper Theranan multi-level encryption and military authentication codes. I did that while you were saying breakfast, which, because your monkey brain works so slowly, I heard as
b-ek-fath.
Got it, Skippy. What's the problem?
We would need that station to receive the message before the Dutchman jumps in on their doorstep. Our modified star carrier would raise way too many suspicions if we just showed up and said, trust me.
Crap. So we need another ship to carry the message for us?
Yep.
And we can't transmit a message directly to that ship either, because any Theranan ship is going to look at us with great suspicion.
But you do have a plan, right? I asked, dreading the answer.
Certainly, and, well...
You are very much not going to like it.
Damn. Whenever I heard Skippy's nervous, well, it set off my spidey senses.
I very, very much did not like Skippy's plan to get a message loaded into a Theranan ship, but Smythe very much did like my plan for his Spec Ops team to gain access to a relay station docking bay without fighting for it. We changed the simulation so that our two dropships were invited into the docking bay by the Theranan, and we then only needed to breach the inner doors. 12 practice runs resulted in much improved results. Most times we took the station quickly, and even the practices that went comparatively badly achieved our goal. Casualties were still unacceptable to my mind. Even Smythe was bothered. My guess is that Spec Ops people are so used to being elite that they had a difficult time contemplating any sort of failure. Smythe reminded the Special Forces of three very important facts. First, the people aboard the Flying Dutchman were indeed very special forces, the absolute most elite and capable combat forces humanity had ever developed.
Second, we would be operating on the enemy's territory, against well-prepared defenses in which the enemy had every advantage. And third, the enemy were genetically enhanced cyborgs with lightning-quick reactions and an instinctive link with their deadly combats. The fact that humans had any chance to capture a Theranan relay station was an enormous tribute to the dedication and training of the Spec Ops team. The 12th and last practice run resulted in only 24 casualties and a successful seizure of the station. Smite told me he did not think further practices would yield better results. We now had a precise plan. Execution of the plan would be up to Smythe's team. It sucked for me to think of sitting safely aboard the Flying Dutchman while my crew took the risks. Paradise. Jesse walked wearily from their private allotment up the hill to the village that had sprung up. Fort Rakovsky now boasted actual buildings made of wood logged from the jungle around them. Jesse and Dave were constructing their own dwelling that they called a hooch, out of timber and a sort of canvas. Eventually, they hoped to replace the canvas. It was only half finished, but already beat the cramped tent they'd been living in for what seemed like forever now. As he came around the corner of a large tent and was startled, "Gah!" he pulled up short like he'd seen a snake. "What the hell is that?" In front of the hooch they'd been constructing off and on, Dave Chaika was sitting in the sunshine with a huge grin on his face, sitting on a couch, the ugliest, most awful couch Jesse had ever seen in his entire life. He'd never even imagined a piece of furniture could be so ugly. It was covered in a wild, garish pattern of some flowers the hamsters liked. "It's a couch," Dave explained. "Our couch. The supply wagon came through. They had some furniture the hamsters discarded. I traded for it. Didn't cost us much."
"You bought that horrible thing?"
"Damn, Ski, I've seen couches on the side of a highway that look better. That's after they got run over a few times and sat out in the sun and rain for years. Damn," he shielded his eyes. "I can't even look directly at that thing." Ski looked at where he was sitting. In truth, the couch had seen better days.
"You're exaggerating. It's not that bad."
"Bad?
It's heinous, man. We've got to get rid of it pronto. That thing is a crime against humanity."
"Come on, Pone." Ski used the shortened version of Jesse's nickname. "It's not that bad."
"Bad? It's hideous. Damn. My ma brought home a couch like that. It used to be her mother's, and I think it belonged to her mother's aunt before that. That couch was evil, man, I tell you. It sat in the living room. My father wouldn't even go in there. One night, my ma comes home. My pa and I were trying to perform an exorcism like in that old movie. You've seen it, right? Ma walks in. We're standing there in the living room with a Bible and a cross shouting, 'The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you.'"
Jesse broke up laughing while telling his own story, remembering his mother's expression. Looking at Jesse, Ski couldn't help laughing, too.
"What happened?" "That evil thing defeated us. Or we got the words wrong or something. My ma was not amused, and that damn couch was still there the next morning. Ma did compromise by putting a cover over the couch, so maybe we did chase that couch's evil spirit out of my ma. My pa still refused to sit on it."
"How about we get a priest or someone to perform an exorcism on this thing?" Ski offered. He hated to give up the couch entirely. Furniture was on very tight supply on Paradise. "A human exorcism won't work on an alien couch, Ski," Jesse explained the obvious, although he was taking a second look at the couch. It was so amazingly ugly that it was kind of cool. "You know why the hamsters gave it up, don't you? It was ugly even to them. Maybe we can throw a coat of paint over it, a fabric dye."
"I don't know." Hesitantly, Jesse touched the fabric. "This alien stuff probably has some high-tech stain blocker. That isn't going to work."
"Pone," Ski lowered his voice. "We need real furniture. We can't keep living on old packing crates and busted-up containers.
That's been good enough for
girls," Dave emphasized. "Expect guys to have at least a couch, you know?"
"Oh,
yeah, oh." Jesse's eyes grew wide as he imagined the possibilities. "You are a freaking genius, Ski. Hey, you know what? That couch is so ugly that it's a, what do you call it? A conversation piece."
"There's only one other real couch in all of Fort Rakovsky," Dave pointed out.
"Hmm. You know what we need now?" Jesse asked, suddenly looking at the couch in a new light.
"What?"
"A real coffee table."
"We don't have coffee. There's none left on Paradise."
"One thing at a time.
Couch first, then coffee table. Then we invite girls over after we get the hooch finished.
Dave gave a big thumbs up to that. Neither he nor Jesse mentioned that there were exactly zero women in Fort Rakowski, population 19. The closest women were in Camp Toffler, a half-hour walk away. Women sometimes came to trade goods, and they saw women when they made the weekly drive into the big town of Fort Cherokee.
"What are you waiting for?" Jesse asked, suddenly no longer tired. "Let's get this couch undercover before it rains, and then we get working on finishing the hooch."
Flying Dutchman. Dinner that night was cooked by the American Spec Ops team, and I had been thinking about it all day. They were serving steaks. Although the galley had a grill, these steaks were prepared steakhouse style. See it on one side, then the steaks go into an oven to bake, so they stay juicy. When they were put on a plate, the seared side goes up because it looks nicer. Anyway, we were having steak. Everything we ate aboard the Flying Dutchman was good. Each national team wanted to outdo the others, and Major Sims had loaded a wide variety of food into our cargo holds. Much of it was frozen or radiated, of course. We also had fresh herbs and vegetables from the hydroponics lab, which had begun as an experiment and now regularly provided fresh food. Skippy disapproved when he saw me skip the vegetable tray after my plate was weighed down by a juicy steak. "Joe, you need to eat your veggies," he scolded me from the speaker. "Duh," I responded. "Do you know how many veggies this cow ate?" "Tons. I'm getting my veggies in concentrated form."
"It doesn't work that way, sir," Sergeant Adams said as she scooped some green thing onto my plate.
I should have known better than to get in line behind her.
"What is that?" I asked suspiciously.
"Brussels sprouts."
"Don't worry. They're not boiled to mush like school lunch Brussels sprouts. These are cooked in a pan with olive oil, salt, and pepper, and then they put a little bit of maple syrup on it for you. They're good. Get some salad, too."
"Is that an order, Staff Sergeant?"
She looked at my collar.
"Not when you're wearing that uniform, Colonel. It's a suggestion, not an order."
I put salad on my plate. And damn it, she was right. It turns out that Brussels sprouts are good, especially with maple syrup.